Okay, the Prime Minister, the new one, I just learned about, says our future is bright. We're going to be nimble and agile in the global economy. So, Das, we're to censor out our negative thoughts, and I demand from you positive vibes about debt, economic growth, sharing economy, low interest rates, etc. Your latest book, and I'll hold it up to the microphone, as is my habit, the intriguingly titled Banquet of Consequences. And it's a different read to your previous works, which would put the boot into some of the more dubious practices in financial markets. A banquet provides more historical background to recent economic crises like the GFC. It's lovely to see you in the studio on my first night back, and congrats on the new book.
Thank you, Philip. I just need to pick a bone with you about pessimism, because I get that quite a bit, but the reality is I'm trying to tell the truth, and I'm trying to deal with facts. Now, one of the interesting things about the world since 2008 is I'm told I'm being pessimistic and the Prime Minister wants to be optimistic, but let's put a few facts on the table. Firstly, the world has zero interest rates, and we've basically had zero interest rates, not in Australia, but in most places, for 6 years. And apparently it's an emergency. So it's a slight contradiction with, on the one hand, we're supposed to be optimistic, yet our central banks are telling us things are an emergency. Central banks have pumped in about $12 trillion into the global economy. Now, that's about 20% of what the world produces in a year, but the most startling fact is, if you take $12 trillion, I was trying to work out what you could do with it. And I worked out you could buy every person on the planet a 60-inch plasma television set. So just looking at those two numbers, I would suggest to you that things are not well in the state of Denmark. The other thing is, if you go and talk to anybody in the street or whatever, and you ask them how they're doing in terms of jobs, prospects, wages, you know, retirement, housing, children, they don't offer a very optimistic view. So to some extent, I'm just reflecting that. And one of the interesting things about that, I use a quote in the book, which is C.S. Lewis, which I genuinely think is the issue today. If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth, only wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair.
The bloke sitting opposite me is much more than a financial analyst. He's also a travel writer extraordinaire, and as you will discover later, an amateur naturalist. But first on to one of the big themes of your new book. And to set up my question, I want to quote from one of your articles called The Owl and the Financier. You wrote, "Raptors, birds of prey, are special to us. The love of birds that hunt for food primarily on the wing using their keen senses fits the DNA of my career. A trader in financial markets, where you eat what you kill."
I think our Prime
sounds
Minister...
Sounds like Tony... It sounds like Malcolm Turnbull to me.
It is, because in some ways he comes from a similar background to me, which is financial markets. The interesting thing about that is capitalism teaches you a few things. One is, in my case, self-sufficiency. Secondly, as an immigrant, I learned that nobody was going to give me a helping hand up. So you have to make what you can of what you've got. So I learned the rather lovely art of having your elbows out and getting what I wanted when I wanted in the best way possible in the circumstance. I didn't want to hurt people, but sometimes, you know, there's collateral damage.
So it's no bad thing to be a raptor. They are, in fact, quite splendid creatures. Do a raptor's skills help a prime minister at a
Absolutely.
Time of crisis?
Because I think fundamentally today we face enormous challenges. The first one is well documented of growth in the global economy, the problems of a buildup of debt. We have a whole range of issues that the world's not growing because innovation has slowed, things like productivity have slowed, and we have all these challenges in terms of water shortages, things like food limitations, things like energy limitations and climate change. We've got these huge challenges. Now, any prime minister worth his salt is going to have to pick his battles and basically push through on policies. They're not necessarily going to be popular all the time. But a good leader in this environment is going to have to seize the nettle and explain to people what's possible and what's not possible and convince them to do the right things.
You say, quote, policymakers pretend they're in control but don't know what happens or why that, and that their ability to influence events is limited. But a lot of commentary today seems to imply that all the economy needs is a new narrative with good salespeople and everything will be okay. Well, we've got a new salesman and a very good one.
Well, I think we need more than sales. I think we need to do certain things. Australia has lived in a sort of delusionary world since 2001, 2002 because of the commodity boom. And frankly, it bailed us out of things like the fact that we weren't competitive, our industry or industrial base was very narrow, our productivity and innovation was not as good as it could be, our infrastructure was poor, all of those issues were there. And all we can say is basically like that wonderful television show that whenever everybody met in cabinet or whatever, they came out with no policy except a communications one about telling people. I heard a minister not too long ago say the reason that they weren't doing well in the polls is because they hadn't put out a few good announcements. And I think I'd like to see people get beyond that and get on with doing a few things.
It's interesting that your book actually takes apart the core economic narrative that Turnbull is pushing. Leaving innovation aside just for a minute, you pull that apart in your book. Why isn't that a strong argument to promote?
Look, there's a guy called Robert Gordon at Northwestern University, and he created this study, which is actually a very interesting one. You can argue about it. But essentially, he said there were three phases of innovation. The first phase of innovation was steam engines and the like. The second was things like the internal combustion engine, rearranging hydrocarbons to make petrol, communications, electricity, a whole bunch of things. And the last one was the computing revolution from the 60s onwards. And he found that the second one, internal combustion engines and so forth, was most powerful. Now, the critical thing is, and he asked the question, why is computing, which we now regard almost like mythically divine, wasn't as important in terms of innovation? And I'll give you a few ideas which underlie why I don't think they are. Number one, they actually do existing things better. I joke that Instagram is not quite the internal combustion engine. Facebook is not nuclear fission, and even Google is not the Gutenberg press. So what they did was take existing
things. Many would regard what you've said as blasphemy.
Absolutely. I'm sure they would. But fundamentally, if you look at today, people hang on to their smartphones and all that sort of stuff. But if you look at that, that does things we did before. I agree, they're quicker, more efficient in some sense. But they also have to understand those industries. Those industries are fascinating. If you look at iPhones and smartphones, what they did was take existing industries, which is mobile phones, personal digital assistants, you know, music, portable music players, and basically cannibalize that. Everybody says smartphones make a lot of money. If you look at the revenues of smartphones, and then you look at all the industries that it's replaced, you find that there's actually not an improvement. And then we have this whole thing called disruptive technologies. And disruptive technologies is actually very important to understand. What they don't do is create sustainable industries. What they do is come in and it's basically like a bee buzzing around a large, cumbersome other animal. So what they do is they come and buzz around, create a lot of noise. And what they're trying to do is pick off by cheapening the cost of the product, finding new people who will buy that product and become an irritant to an industry incumbent. And what they really want to do is be bought by that. I'll give you a very good example of that, eBay. eBay was created as a very community-based initiative where people with surplus things would sell them to each other. Today, eBay is just a marketing channel for existing large vendors of products. There's another thing that's going on in banking, for instance, called peer-to-peer lending. So if I have some cash, rather than putting it in a bank, you have a small business, and I think your business is a good one, you come to me and we are matched and I lend you some money because it's cheaper for you to borrow and I get a little higher interest rate. But that whole business has now changed in less than 5 years, where it's actually used by banks to lend to people and hedge funds and institutions to lend to people. So all of these innovations are not really that significant in the greater scheme of things. Now, I'm not ever saying that we won't have innovations, but the crucial thing is, what impact will they have on things like growth and jobs. And I'll give you a wonderful, wonderful example of that. Walter Rathauer, who was basically the head of the United Auto Workers in the United States, in the 1950s, this is going back to the 1950s or 60s, he was taken by a Ford executive to one of their new plants. And the new guy sort of said to Walter, and he says, look at those robots. And he said, yes, I'm looking at the robots. And he said, well, how are you going to collect union dues from those people? Rather turned around to him and said, how are you going to get the robots to buy new cars? So basically, all our innovation at the moment is stripping jobs out and lowering living standards.
What about the agricultural sector? What about food production?
Look, if you ask me, there are three or four things where innovation would have huge impact. First, if you look at agriculture, the first thing to remember is the amount of acreage that's farmed in the world is 3.4 billion acres. It hasn't changed for 30 or 40 years. And we now have to increase food production by, depending on whose numbers you believe, between 50 and 100% to feed people. And that's because the population's growing, but more importantly, as people move up the socioeconomic scale, they consume things like meat, etc., which require far more in terms of acreage and production, and their protein equivalent is not the same as the additional amount of grain they consume. So we're going to have to find solutions to that. If you look at all the grains we consume, if you actually look at the number of actual crops we use, they've come down from hundreds to like eight or nine. And we're now very, very vulnerable to two things. One is getting the yields up in terms of getting more out of those crops. And we're now seeing what's called a decaying S-curve, which basically means the rate of improvements are stagnating because we're reaching certain biological limits. But the worst part about it is a different one, which is because we're now so dependent on so few strains. If you get something like
potato famine, exactly, all over again.
Exactly. That's exactly the potato famine. All of those things can be repeated very, very quickly.
A monoculture is vulnerable.
A monoculture always is extremely vulnerable.
Yeah. Okay. What about education? That's an area where there's a certain amount of disruption going on.
Look, I think whatever else people agree or disagree on, having people who are better educated is essential in every sense of the word. And I mean that in terms of the economy, but I also mean that in terms of civics, of having an informed voter and being able to participate in democracy, all of those sorts of things. But we've sort of dumbed down education quite a bit. Jane Jacobs, who is one of my favorite writers in the United States, actually has this wonderful term she uses. She doesn't talk about education. She talks about credentializing. We don't actually have education. We don't have basic skills. We give people credentials so they can get a job. And one of the problems with that is the jobs are changing so quickly that credentializing doesn't work. But fundamentally, I think there's a problem underlying things like education. We now burden people who go to university with huge amounts of debt as well, which is part of the financialization of the education system. But the other thing, which I think with education, is at the end of education, you have to have people with jobs. There's a wonderful debate in Europe and about cutting expenditures. And one of the saddest commentaries I saw was from somebody who was involved in the teaching professions. He said, well, one way to actually cut spending is to avoid spending money on education, because the people who are educating don't need to be educated because there are no jobs for them to go to.
Let's go back to tooth and claw capitalism. Free trade, it's not free, is it?
No, it's never been free. It's always been managed. It's always been managed. One of the wonderful things about free trade is we talk about free trade. If trade was really free, why do we have constant debates about free trade agreements and multilateral arrangements of cutting this and cutting that? If it was free, that would never actually have ever occurred. But it's also very, very anomalous to look at free trade because it's free trade in goods and services, certain goods and services, but it's never been in people. It's never been in people. A truly global system would allow people to move from one part of the world to the other. We've never have. One of the fascinating things about America, and you talked about tooth and claw capitalism, one of the wonderful things about America is because it promises such great riches, it sucks talent out of other countries. So they're trained in other countries, they get their education in other countries.
It sucks talent out of film industries.
Absolutely.
It sucks talent out of everything. The United States has always been a vast hoover.
Absolutely. And they've been brilliant at it because they never bear the costs of it, but they get the benefits of it. So it's never really been free. And what I see going forward is actually a terrifying picture. And let's start with a number. If you look at the period from 1980 to, say, 2006, during that period, global trade grew at 7%. And that was double the rate of economic growth in the world. Today, global trade is not growing. And it's the first time in a very long time it's not growing. And what people are speculating is, does this actually mean that the global economy is going to shrink? And I think it points to some really profound changes. The first change is people are moving to autarkies, which means they're closing their borders and basically concentrating on domestic things. And the reason is pretty simple. You trade when the world is growing and you can benefit from it. Today, the world isn't growing at the same rate. So for a lot of actors, particularly large countries or large trading blocks, there is no advantage in trading. And so they're basically concentrating on domestic production. And the other thing which is really fascinating is there are events in the last probably 10 years which have pointed to the weaknesses of this sort of massive global supply chain where we get cloth from here, a zipper from here, a button from here, and assemble it somewhere else to get a pair of trousers. And one of them is as currencies move, you don't know where to get what, and it becomes very dysfunctional, this whole supply chain. And the classic example that I actually use in the book is Mexico and China. Mexico became uncompetitive because of China's lower cost. But as Chinese wages grew and the yuan, the Chinese currency, appreciated, Mexico has now become more competitive. And the other thing is Mexico, essentially because of its physical proximity to the US, has now started to exploit that. So these massive swings mean that people are actually moving away from free trade in every sense of the word.
You make a nice point about the debate on economic growth, that it's like Beckett's play Waiting for Godot. The politicians keep telling us that growth is just around the corner if we follow this or that policy, but it doesn't quite turn up.
Look, I think I don't want to be unkind to politicians and policymakers. They have a very difficult task at the moment. What I find disturbing about the narrative is it's always about, oh, if we just cut interest rates just a little bit, if we do this, it'll come along. But the reality is we are allowing ourselves as a group of people to be misled by them, because to some extent, it's a collective delusion. We don't want to believe that the good times have come to an end. We don't want to believe that the inexhaustible entitlements that we've promised ourselves are there. So we want to believe what the politicians take us, not because it's true, but because it suits us to believe that.
And well,
that
willful ignorance is...
It's willful ignorance.
Yeah. Ellen Elm on RN, on air, online, on your pod, and I'm talking to Das about, well, lots of things. Since the GFC, we've talked about low interest rates, but part of an agile and nimble economy is embracing what's called the sharing economy. You mentioned it in passing. That's supposed to be an engine of growth, is it?
Well, Robert Reich, who you know, calls it the share the scraps economy. And it's a classic disruptive behavior. Now, let's take Uber, which is always being debated. The fascinating thing about Uber is it's sold as this wonderful, almost 60s hippie movement of you helping a new friend. Airbnb, which is the sort of lend out your home system, is about making new friends. The reality is these are people who can't necessarily, not all of them, but some of them, make a living from what they're actually doing. And they're using their assets, whether it be a car or a house or a spare room, to make a living. And the entire business model is actually built on actually deceit, which is we won't actually obey regulations. So if you actually want a bed and breakfast, you have to comply with all these legal rules. If you want to have a travel company or a car, you have to comply with all these legal rules. So this is based on this sort of form of arbitrage of these rules. And the reality is this does not work unless the people doing the service are doing it cheaper than everybody else. And it's disintermediating existing operators at a much, much lower cost. And there was a wonderful piece, and I just forget who did it, a journalist who spent time in the sharing economy, and she documented the exploitation of individual providers. And all the stuff about you have flexibility, you have this, is actually far from the real truth, is we're creating actually, to some extent, an underclass of people who are going to be doing that and who are just basically not dissimilar to the peace workers of the 18th and 19th century. That's what they are. Do they have retirement benefits? Do they have healthcare benefits? Do they have any of that? And the answer has to be no.
Let's remember Thomas Piketty's book, Capital. Big success, written, well, I think as recently as last year. Talked about growing inequality. You don't disagree that there is increasing inequality, but you don't think much of Piketty's arguments.
Look, Piketty's arguments are quite fascinating, but just before I talk about the argument, there's something very funny about the Piketty book. When it was being sold for about $40, the hardback. And the funny thing was, if you actually go to eBay at the same time, which is when I was looking at it, you could get a well-thumbed copy, but it costs 10 times the amount. So I figured a lot of people were buying that and putting that on their lounge tables to sort of almost feign this deep understanding of the Piketty debate, which is
so
kind of interesting.
It becomes a bit analogous to Stephen Hawking's book, which was the biggest seller of all time for 10 minutes.
Much more, no one could understand. Yeah, I actually did read it, and I have to confess, I understood about a tenth of it, is the best I could say. But coming back to Piketty's argument, my point is, Piketty's argument comes down to a very simple equation. He believes all that you need to explain inequality is the rate of return on capital versus the growth rate. I think inequality is important, but it's much subtler than that. And it's subtle because of the way the mix between jobs which are permanent versus temporary jobs. It's the mix between how much capital gets in terms of corporate profits versus what other people get. It's how much we actually spend on things like education, health. And it's also a function of policies, like the policy of low interest rates that we were talking about earlier, which has boosted things like house prices and share prices, has benefited only a small group of people. And the cutbacks that austerity have done has basically affected healthcare expenses. It's affected things like essentially education, which affects the ability of people to actually get on with their lives and improve their lives. So I don't think Piketty's wrong. I think Piketty's simplification of the argument to a simple thing that if I can fix R and G, isn't right. And the other thing is, his answer to all of this was, let's put up all the tax rates to 80%. And what I found quite puzzling is he didn't actually address the fact that, remember, in the 60s and 70s, we had very, very high tax rates in places like England. I remember that because the Rolling Stones, when they had to make Exile on Main Street, had to decamp from England and basically lived in France for a long period of time. And that did not actually help equality any more than any other measure that we've had. So I think we need to have a debate about equality, but it's also national, but it's also international. I'll give you a very good example of this. In terms of equality and inequality, the debate within one country is only one part of it. And we saw this very, very clearly the year before that. Remember the Rana Plaza tragedy in Bangladesh, which focused attention on the plight of garment workers and the fact that they were working in unsafe environments for a pittance to provide clothing for people like Gap and all sorts of other companies around the world. But the fundamental thing was, nobody would acknowledge that everybody has to actually pay slightly more, a few cents more effectively, for their garments to actually improve the lot of those people. And that debate just died after a year, and a few people keep sort of trying to take it forward. And the other thing is that inequality globally is going to make it extremely difficult to resolve issues which are cross-border. You can't solve the problem of climate emissions controls unless everybody agrees. You can't solve the problem of water use unless everybody agrees. And we have inequality at multiple levels that we need to try to deal with. And the way we've dealt with it is by growth. Because if the pie gets bigger, there's a lot of trickle down. And that's not going to happen. So that problem is going to come home to haunt us in a much, much more serious way.
I've just been travelling around a communist state. The hammer and sickle is still on display. It's a remarkably relaxed society compared to the one next door, Cambodia, which has some claims to democracy, but it is in fact the sleaziest place I've ever looked at. And it occurs to me that the other discussion we've got to have, whether we like it or not, is whether democracy, however you define it, is up to the task. I remember discussions ages ago about the Chinese response to climate change issues, where they were actually, because it was authoritarian, they were able to do something significant, where a society like ours finds it terribly hard to make any decision that's politically tough. Do you have a view on whether democracy is going to last the distance?
Well, I think more time goes on, the more I find democracy unsatisfactory in various respects. And I think it's because I think we're trying to balance many things. We're trying to balance economic objectives, social objectives, personal freedoms in a strange sort of mixture. And it's very hard. And fundamentally, if you look at large societies, Manker Olson, who very famously wrote the book, The Logic of Collective Actions, actually in the 60s, I think he wrote his books, identified the problem, which is in large democracies, what happens is the actual process of governing becomes complicated, so large lobby groups form. And what they do is they obviously argue for their particular constituencies, and essentially because they can actually act against each other, they ossify government to the point where nothing actually happens. And it's a bit like the countervailing forces argument that Galbraith put forward. So what happens in all these societies is basically nothing actually can get done. And I think we're actually very close to that in many places. I look at Australia, I look at America, I look at Britain, and one of the fundamental things that you see is you can't get actual agreement on anything. Even if all of us, like on refugees, etc., agree at a visceral moral and ethical level that this is a problem. And part of it is also the electoral cycle. And it's interesting, I use the phrase NIMTOs, not in my term of office. And it actually works in two vicious ways. One is, I don't want to take any hard decisions in my term of office because that might prevent me from coming back into power. But it also prevents me from making decisions where the payoff from that is not in my term of office, but some future person will benefit from that. And I think we've got to break this logjam in some shape or form. And part of it, I think, is to have the right items debated properly. And it's
what are the right items to debate?
Oh, very simple. What amount of economic growth we can sustain within the constraints we have of population growth, of environment, of resource constraint. We have to have some basic idea of fairness of how we actually cut up the pie. And we can always have a debate about what is that right argument. And I don't think there is a right argument about that. We also need to understand that our institutions inherently are deeply flawed, but we have to work within them and try to improve them to the best way possible. And the other thing at the heart of all of this, I believe, is, and probably the one picture that made the biggest impression on my life, and I'm sure on many others, was that photo from the first Apollo mission flying out into space when it looked back on Earth. And I still vividly remember that photo the first time I saw it. And the Earth looked like this tiny thing in this total blackness. And we don't have any other planet, and we're not going to be able to escape this. So unless we take steps to control our own urges, it's going to be problematic. And it's basically what Gandhi once said. Not, as you know, I'm not one of Gandhi's great fans, but you know, there's enough on the earth for man's needs, but not enough for man's greed.
Okay. The you mentioned in passing population. Have you come to a view about population as an issue? It's remarkable how rarely it is discussed.
Look, it is clear that the number of people on that the carrying capacity of Earth is constrained. It's a closed system, so it's going to have to actually be controlled to some degree. And the most interesting thing that people forget is in the 20th century, the population of the Earth doubled twice, which is actually a big factor in economic growth. It's not going to even double once, thankfully, in the 21st century. And all the forecasts are coming down. But we also then have to actually look through the population. And basically, we obviously have to control it, but we then have to balance on the other side that lower population means lower growth, difficulty in managing tax bases and entitlement expenses. So we need to have that debate about population. And I think the population of the earth has to come down. I think Edward Abbey summed this up very, very neatly once when he said, endless and mindless growth is the ideology of a cancer cell. And that applies to population.
And been wandering around the ruins of Angkor. At one point, about 800 years ago, it was the biggest city on earth. It wasn't just a pile of temples.
Yeah.
A million people
lived there.
When London, I think, was about 30 or 40,000, then something happened, and no one quite knows why. There are arguments that it was war, that it was disease. It was certainly drought, probably of a scale that correlates to what we'd call climate change.
Indeed.
And this takes us back, doesn't it, to that issue, which I know concerns you deeply, which is not being properly discussed.
No. I mean, it's not being discussed, and there's an image which I've always loved. As you know, the Aral Sea used to be a very fertile area. It was provided, I think, something like 10 or 15% of the Soviet Union's fish catch, which is now completely dry.
And I can remember photographs of that which haunt me, like the famous NASA photograph haunts you.
Exactly, which is the boats sitting in the middle of a dry sea.
Yeah.
And there's a Dali painting which actually mirrors that, which is a small boat which is stranded on a desert with basically just slowly decaying away. And every time I look at it, I look at places like Angkor Wat, I look at Machu Picchu, I look at Tikal in Guatemala, and I see the impermanence of any civilization. And I think we don't address that sufficiently, because the Earth has about 4.6 billion years to go. If we're not careful, the people and creatures which will actually inhabit the Earth will not be this particular species of Homo sapiens.
Let's swing back in our last minutes to something I mentioned earlier when quoting your Owl piece, and that is you have a passionate interest in environmental issues.
I just don't like people.
And in particular, you've become a birdie, haven't you? You've now seen how many bird species?
Oh, somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000.
Out of a total
about
of?
About 10. Oh, look, people have got up to 9,800, so I'm not even in their league. But I'll tell you one thing we did see, because we spent a delightful time in Uganda. It was a shoebill stork, which we've always wanted to see. It's 4 foot high, has a family all its own, has a head, which its nickname, a king whale head, gives you an idea. It's the most massive head that you've ever seen, and it's completely prehistoric. And, you know, people asked us why we went to Uganda. We said to see a shoebill stork, and they looked at us completely uncomprehendingly, like, why would you want to do that? Extraordinary creatures. And that's the other thing about that, is as part of the destruction of climate and everything else, these creatures are as important on Earth as we are. They're as finely evolved in their own ways as evidence of life on Earth. And we're destroying them without even a thought.
I had a rather pleasant preparation for tonight's program because I was reading some of your essays, including the one that we quoted from, The Owl and the Financier, and that sent you off to Finland to look at owls.
Oh, look, Finland is the greatest place to see owls because they nest. You can see 5 or 6 species of owls. But I'll tell you a really funny quick story about that, because we had a lovely guide called Tony. And Ural owls are beautiful-looking owls, but they've actually got a very nasty mean streak. And he was telling us a story about a bunch of British birders who were looking for Ural owls. And the guide said to them, just be a little careful because they can sometimes swoop you, which just means they attack. So anyway, I'll go and have a look at the nest site and see if the bird's there and it's all calm. So the guide goes off into the bushes and the British birders are standing around waiting. And then they, after about 10 or 15 meters, hear this sort of thing rushing through the bushes. And there is the guide running through the bushes with the Ural owl behind in hot pursuit. And with typical British understatement, when asked later whether they'd seen an Ural owl, one British birder sort of very reflectively said, "We saw the Ural owl very well in flight."
We've spoken before about financial problems in Brazil, but I haven't revealed to the listener that you visited Brazil to observe giant anteaters.
Look, we love anteaters. They're the most extraordinary-looking creatures, and when we went to look for them, our guide, a lovely guy called Frederico, sort of gets on this hillock. It's a very flat area because they're in savannah, and he sort of says, okay, well, there's an anteater there. I couldn't see anything for the life of me, and this is like a kilometre away. Anyway, we go down there and he can't find it. We go back to the hillock. He looks down. He says, oh, I went slightly the wrong way. We went in. And then we started to walk through long grass. And suddenly in front of us, this was this thing, which is about probably 6 or 7 feet from nose to tail. It's very rough, matted hair. And you see it. It's black and white. And against the yellow of the savanna grass, it's almost invisible. In fact, there were 2 anteaters. And we had our David Attenborough moment. So we got downwind of them because they can't see very well, but they smell very well. And so we were walking along with them. And there's a moment, you see, these creatures have evolved over tens of millions of years. They don't harm us in any shape or form, though they are very powerful creatures. And we walked and walked and walked with them. And it's just, you know, I when I die on my deathbed, I hope I can remember some of these experiences like giant anteaters. And in our last holiday, we saw an aardvark and a pangolin. So we were very excited.
Das, thanks for coming in. Das's new book, A Banquet of Consequences, and it's published by Viking. Tomorrow on the Little Wireless program, Shapiro, and we talk about what's happening in Ukraine. And Gladys, check your teeth, because we're going to tell you a story about the smile revolution. And that's not the takeover in Canberra. I promise you it's a much bigger story than that. That's your lot for now. The news on RN is next.